The Rosenbeck Museum and Library presents Sherlock Mondays, hosted by Edward G. Pettit.
Welcome to Sherlock Mondays. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbeck Museum and Library in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and we're going on a biblioventure through the stories of Sherlock Holmes. This is episode 27, The Adventure of the Naval Treaty. And joining me as co-host, all the way from across the sea, is Anastasia Klimchinskaya. Hey, Anastasia.
Hi, Ed. It's really great to be here. And we had daylight savings time just yesterday here in Europe. So you're lucky I got the time right.
You're way in the future right now.
I am way in the future. It's even Tuesday where I am, tomorrow. Actually. It's Sherlock Tuesdays.
I'm talking to you tomorrow. So there you go.
how fitting.
Well, you know, we have four shows left. This is like, it's coming to a close. This is the last one that you'll be on for talking about a story until we do Hound of the Baskervilles, of course. And you'll be on for the wrap-up show, of course. So mm-hmm. have lots more of you, which is wonderful. But we do have four more shows of Sherlock Mondays to deduce, decipher, dissect Arthur Conan Doyle's stories about the world's first consulting detective, Sherlock Holmes, and his able assistant, Dr. John Watson, in a kind of conversational annotation. If you're watching right now, I invite you to please like these videos if you so choose. I hope you would like them. And subscribe to the Rosenbeck's YouTube channel. That helps us get greater visibility on YouTube and grow more audience. Sherlock Mondays is also an audio podcast, so thank you to all of our podcast listeners as well. I would also ask everyone to please consider to make a donation to the Rosenbeck. If you've already donated or joined as a member of the Rosenbeck, thank you so much. That's how we get to do this show for free, because of your support for the Rosenbeck. And if you've not already donated or become a member, I invite you to do so. We have four more shows for you to do that. I will tell you how to register for our special subscription-only Hound of the Baskerville show at the mid-break. But before we start tonight, Anastasia, I have to tell you and everyone else what we're drinking. You're drinking something special. You're in Slovenia.
I'm in Slovenia, yeah. I'm a different time zone, different continent, different everything.
Slovenian liqueur there or something, don't you?
Yeah, I don't have the bottle, so I just have the wine glass. But yes, it's called Borovničevec, which is a Slovenian blueberry liqueur that is absolutely delicious, that I don't think you're supposed to drink out of a wine glass, but it's what I have with me here. I'm traveling, so I don't, you know, unfortunately I don't travel with a full bar, but this is more than enough for me.
Well, that sounds delicious. I have a different one. Every episode features a Sherlock tale designed by our good friend and co-host, Mary El Caro. You can find the recipes in the YouTube description for the episode, and I send it out, the recipe, via email every week for those who are registered for the show. You can register at the Sherlock Mondays homepage on rosenbeck.org. Not too late. If you're just joining in, you want to register now for the last few episodes, you can do so. But tonight, we're having a nice cup of coffee to clear the brain. This is a take. It's called Brain Fever. You remember Percy was feeling drowsy and stupid, partly from my dinner and also from the effects of a long day's work. A cup of coffee would clear my brain. And then he got brain fever. A take on the mind eraser. It was supposed to be a layered drink. This was layered when I made it, and now it's just, but it's been sitting for a few minutes and it's kind of mixed. I didn't layer it well enough. But it's espresso and vodka and Amaro and tonic water and a little lemon juice. I changed it slightly in that I used a Pellegrino limonata for the, instead of lemon and tonic or seltzer, I had it in one And it's got a little sugar, so I like that better too. So there it is, Twist on a Mind Eraser. Clear your brain just a little too well. And you're supposed to, see, it should be layered. And then as you have a straw, you literally drink the layers. You drink all the, you know, espresso and then the vodka and then the Amaro. But mine's kind of mixed up a little bit here, so.
Yeah, you know, people who drink coffee after like 3 p.m. terrify me because I can't do that. Coffee is for the mornings. And if I go past a certain time, then I don't sleep. So when he's like, oh yeah, I'll just have some coffee at like 10 p.m., that's just horrifying to me.
This is tasty. I wasn't sure I was really going to like it. I really like it. It's very refreshing. Man, oh man, that's good. Yeah. Yeah, I could drink coffee anytime. I could drink coffee and then just go to bed. So
yeah, people like that terrify me.
Caffeine.
If only I had that superpower, it would be all over for all of you.
Not sure it's a superpower, but it is, it's convenient, but it's inconvenient if you need like a little pickup, you know? So I don't get the pickup from coffee. So, all righty. Well, we have shared a PDF of a facsimile of the adventure of the Naval Treaty as it was originally published in 2 issues of the Strand magazine. This is the longest Sherlock Holmes story. For some of you who are reading along every week and then suddenly got to this, and maybe you had a certain amount of time, you allotted, you knew I would read it, and then you were like, oh my gosh, this story's long. It is. It's a double story. It's literally twice as many words as the usual Sherlock Holmes story. And it was published in the Strand magazine in October and November 1893. We'll see at the point there where it turns over. There's no cliffhanger, you know, and you know, to change issues. You can download this story, especially if you're listening on the audio podcast, because we do talk about some of the images from it, and we have a facsimile of it on the Rosenbeck's Sherlock Mondays page. Just a little bit of bio before we start, Anastasia. Doyle was doing exceptionally well in his writing career. I mean, really throughout 1893, he's making really good money. He's traveling. He's redecorating his house. I think around when this story is published, he's like, he redoes the whole house. But almost all of his published fiction in 1893 are Sherlock Holmes stories. And this will play a role in how he wants to change his life. In 1892, the year before, he published 7 Sherlock Holmes stories, 7 other stories, and 2 short novels. And then in 1893, it was 11 Sherlock Holmes adventures, just three other stories, and a couple plays. So most of his published works now are Sherlock Holmes stories, which is, of course, leading him to be able to travel and redecorate his house and enjoy life more. But he's also getting a little tired of Sherlock, and he wants to really, you know, do some other things. I think one of the reasons, I think I mentioned this the last episode with Curtis, when we talked about Greek interpreter, I think one of the reasons that Naval Treaty is so long is because he could just write a really long one, and then it's 2 months, and then it's one less adventure he has to put together while he can, you know, look at and work on other things. We find it but he did, right?
I'm sorry?
I said we find it shocking that he would tire of Sherlock, because we don't. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's quite, well, I mean, I don't know how famous this is outside of Sherlockian circles. I have this problem that once you've been a Sherlockian for long enough, you don't know what the sort of average non-Sherlockian person knows. But Doyle was sort of very famously kind of bored of Sherlock Holmes, thought it wasn't his greatest work. He was very interested in his historical fiction, all this other writing. But Sherlock Holmes is really what he is remembered for, and most of his other works we forget. There's a great quote when Sherlock Holmes is being adapted to a stage play, and he got a letter from the person doing the adapting, you know, that said, "Can I marry off Sherlock Holmes?" And famously, Doyle wrote back, "You can marry him or murder him or do what you will with him." And people really sort of take that one quote from that letter and use it as a symbol of how much Doyle just didn't like Holmes. Although I think that does tend to get exaggerated a little bit for comic effect, really.
And especially considering, you know, the number of Sherlock Holmes stories that he still wrote, and so many of them are so good. But we're not going to go in the future, and we're definitely not going to talk about next week's story, because I really want to not, you know, there are people who have, or were just reading these for the first time. But for now, in his bio, Doyle's clearly tiring of this stuff, and now he's written this very long story called The Naval Treaty. And Watson gives us a setting for it, the July which immediately succeeded my marriage. So it's the July after the Sign of Four, in a sense, because the Sign of Four, he meets Mary Morstan and gets married, you know, or it's the second marriage, because there's people that, you know, go with the second marriage of Watson, too. Watson talks about, he says, he was involved in three cases with Sherlock that month, so that he's no longer living with him. But he's still getting involved in cases, clearly, because we get some of them. And
obviously, he doesn't know how to say no to Sherlock Holmes, as we've seen in many of the other stories.
He doesn't want to say no. And his wife doesn't want him to say no either. Go with Sherlock.
Yeah, his wife is incredibly patient.
Yes.
Well,
he mentions two here, and one of them, he says, is there's three adventures. One of them is The Adventure of the Second Stain. The other one is The Naval Treaty, which we get. And the other is The Adventure of the Tired Captain. Now, for now, this is still just the second stain that he's mentioning is still an unpublished case. He will write The Second Stain like 12 years from now, from when it's published. And then when he does, it doesn't match his description at all here.
You know? Yeah, I was rereading this and I did a little take, sort of like, that's not how I remember The Second Stain going.
It doesn't at all. It involves the first families in the kingdom, so he can't make it public. And it demonstrated the true facts of the case. Holmes demonstrated the true facts of the case to Monsieur Dubuque of the Paris police and Fritz von Waldbaum, the well-known specialist of Danzig. But that's not what happens on the second stage. 12 years later, when he finally just says, yeah, I think I'll use that name in the story. He's also he's in the memoirs publication of these stories. He will take the story of the yellow face and add the second stain to the mention of that. So it winds up then two stories mention the second stain, because originally in Yellow Face, he mentioned that the Musgrave ritual was one of those cases in which Sherlock Holmes erred, but the truth was still discovered. Well, then when he wrote Musgrave, like a few months later, that's not the case at all. Sherlock doesn't err, then the truth is discovered anyway. Sherlock figures it out, then they discover, you know, what happened. So he changes at the second stain, I think, and probably because now he's already written Musgrave, it doesn't fit that description. So when he publishes memoirs, so you could have an edition where it actually says second stain in Yellow Face and Naval Treaty, that he mentions them. So, well, now he's just mentioning three interesting cases that occurred, but what's interesting is he gives us nothing about the tired captain. It's like the second stain is all this, but let me tell you about the second one. What about the tired captain? We don't know. So
No, she just wanted to brag about how Sherlock Holmes showed up these specialists. I always love when there's a mention of Paris. I used to live in Paris and be part of the Sherlockian Society there, but Sherlock Holmes never visited Paris. It just keeps getting mentioned sort of in passing in relation to his cases. Very frustrating for us, sort of.
Isn't he in
Parisian Sherlockians?
He's in Paris when Watson goes. He's doing a case and he's exhausted, and Watson has to go to the Hotel Lyon and get him, right?
I assume that's in the city of Lyon, not the city of Paris, but I could be wrong.
Paris, yeah. So But never in Paris. At least we don't get a mention of him in Paris.
Not as far as we know. Although I think some Sherlockians calculated that in order to get to the Reichenbach Falls, he would have to go through Paris to get there from England.
I like how he calls this, which I'm assuming he means a detective, kind of like him, the well-known specialist.
But I thought Sherlock Holmes was the only one in the world.
Yeah, so
times are changing. People are copycatting him.
The only consulting detective. Watson doesn't want to call this other guy that. He's just a specialist. So, Watson now, to lead up to this case, he starts talking about, during my school days, I had been intimately associated with a lad named Percy Phelps, same age as myself, though he was two classes ahead of me. He was a brilliant boy, carried away every prize. And he continued at Cambridge. He was well connected, his mother's brother's Lord Holdhurst. And then Watson says, this gaudy relationship did him little good at school. On the contrary, it seemed rather a piquant thing to us to chevy him about the playground and hit him over the shins with a wicket. Really, Watson?
I mean, British schoolboys are just unrelenting. I mean, you've read Lord of the Flies, Ed. What can you expect?
Bullying the geek in school. This is what Watson was doing. He gives that kind of excuse. Then right afterwards, he says, it was another thing when he came out and into the world. Yeah, you're not going to hit him in the shins with your cricket bat then. But I mean, this is, or with a wicket. It does upset me that Watson was a bully and he was just like, yeah, we just bullied him. It was all in fun. That's what the bullies always say, right? Like, oh, it was just fun. He was fine.
Things were just different back in those days.
Bullying doesn't change. That's still around.
Yeah.
But now Percy has a good position at the Foreign Office and and he writes to Watson, as my dear Watson, I have no doubt that you can remember Tadpole Phelps. It all makes me cringe a little, like that he was quite okay with being, kind of bullied by these other boys and now he's gone. But this is the way the story gets told by those who do the bullying too, that, oh, he was fine. Don't worry about it. Well, Phelps has got this good appointment at the Foreign Office, but a horrible misfortune has come over him, and now he has only just recovered from 9 weeks of brain fever, and he's hoping that Watson's friend, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, will come to see him. I have been off my head ever since the blow fell, your old school fellow, Percy Phelps. We've seen brain fever a few times, Anastasia, in these stories, but it's always a woman with brain fever. Alice Rucastle, Copper Beaches, had brain fever after her father, bullied her and locked her up in the tower, of the house. Sarah Cushing, who was the sister, whose sister was murdered in cardboard box. Rachel, whose name I can't remember, in Musgrave Ritual, and Nancy Barkley, the wife in Crooked Man, all have brain fever. Percy's the only man afflicted with brain fever in this, and for the stories to come, too. Spoiler, no other man ever gets brain fever in a Sherlock Holmes story. I wonder, does this say something, Anastasia, think about how he's portraying Percy, that in Doyle's kind of gendered mind, the kind of thing that is usually associated with, for him, the weaker sex, for women would get this. And here now he's portraying a man with it. Is this him kind of, is Doyle saying something about Percy by having him?
I didn't get that sense. I think, in a way, that's almost kind of a modern way to look at it, in the sense that I think the Victorians had this kind of sense that the mental could reflect itself on your physical health. Like, your psychological state could really reflect itself on your physical health, in a way that I think in the modern day, we kind of really try to repudiate. We have this attitude of sort of the mental and the physical are so different. But for the Victorians, at least if you read the literature, there really is this sense that, yes, you can be struck by anxiety or stress or any number of kind of mental problems that will reflect themselves physically. And that was something that I think we could learn from, yeah. Because if you get too stressed or too anxious, I mean, your body will rebel. I'm also remembering in Dracula, of course, the Jonathan Harker, after his experience of Dracula's castle, he just, you know, gets brain fever and goes a little mad for a few weeks.
He does. But there
is some interesting things going on there. But I think that there is this kind of sense in so much Victorian literature that sort of that's not an abnormal response to have to a situation of great stress.
Stoker, as I recall, though, really, you know, in Dracula, he's really lining Jonathan up as a kind of gothic heroine and putting him in those same kind of scenarios when he's in the castle. And I think he does that in there. And then Jonathan has to become kind of more manly for Stoker through the rest of Dracula to deal with this. And I can't help but think that Percy is shown here as this very weak-willed person. And the only other people that Doyle afflicts with this are women. So,
I mean, it is, I think, a possible reading if you combine it with all of the kind of, he's the victim of all of this bullying, and a few other moments in the story. I mean, I think it's a possible reading. I'm not sure that I would kind of approach it that way, but I can see how one could make that reading.
Well, we'll see how Percy is in the rest of this story too. The Watson figures Holmes will help him, of course, he goes. My wife agreed, of course, that he should lose no time in going back to, you know, see Sherlock, even at breakfast. And he finds Holmes seated at his side table, clad in his dressing gown, although he doesn't tell us what color that dressing gown is, and working hard over a chemical investigation.
I just find it so interesting that sort of at this point, Watson is being contacted rather than Holmes directly. I mean, it's not like Watson is Holmes' secretary, but it almost is, where people now know that Holmes and Watson are kind of a unit, so they contact Watson in order to get to Holmes rather than, you know, just addressing Holmes directly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this case comes completely from Watson. He's bringing it to Holmes.
Which is interesting. Does he? I don't think Watson himself brings that many cases to Holmes, as I recall. I bet there's somebody in the chat who's
I don't think he's,
like, there's three or something.
I'm not sure he's done it yet. You know, Twisted Lip starts, he has a case, and then Holmes takes him on a different case, not related to that. No, I think, you know, and some things it's through Watson that Holmes winds up on these cases. But like Reigate Squires, Holmes goes, Watson takes him on vacation. That's where it happens. But as far as Watson, Engineer's Thumb, he brings him to him. So maybe that's the only other one so far. He brings the engineer to Holmes.
I mean, it just, to me, it signals such an interesting kind of, I guess, progression in their relationship, where it's not just Holmes coming to fetch Watson whenever he needs him. It's also Watson bringing Holmes cases.
And someone has specifically asked Watson to bring it to Holmes. So that's it's a clear difference. Well, Holmes is at his chemical experiments, and I just want to share that. There's an illustration I want to share. Here he is, Holmes in his dressing gown, leaning over his chemical apparatus here. doing an experiment. Holmes is usually doing chemistry to, even though when we first meet him in Study in Scarlet, he's working on things to help with, you know, his criminal detection. But then I think he's usually just doing chemical investigations as something to occupy his mind between cases. Mm-hmm. But this time he's actually working on the confirmation of guilt of somebody, and he's found some test that will, you know, help it. So a nice example of Holmes, the using science in criminal detection.
Yeah, Holmes, the forensic specialist, and you know, if we trace the sort of the CSI kind of procedural back to Sherlock Holmes, it's actually quite interesting that sort of this is the job of like the forensic tech of all the people that the police department now employs for this kind of thing. So CSI and shows like that always have the like forensic tech character who's always doing this kind of thing. But Holmes is his own forensic laboratory at this moment in time, because police departments don't do that yet. Crime solving is this kind of methodology isn't established yet. So Holmes is the detective and the forensic tech and the sort of just beat policeman and just all of them in one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what we see here. Holmes doing this kind of forensic detective work to solve a case that we know nothing of and we don't learn what it is. So, but it's clearly, it means someone's life. And, you know, and this person, I think what he means is he's guilty. That's confirmed. And then, he's busy. So Watson, you will find the tobacco in the Persian slipper where he keeps his tobacco.
Yes.
And then realizes, and then stops, and he draws up his knees until his fingers clasp around the long, thin shins. A very commonplace little murder, the one he's working on. But you've got something better, I fancy. You are the stormy petrel of crime, Watson. What? You know, Holmes had called himself a stormy petrel in Reigate Squires, because they showed up at this guy's house and suddenly all these crimes were happening, and Holmes called himself a stormy petrel. But here, it's Doyle must have liked this metaphor, right? Now he's got a couple stories later, he's using it again, but he's improved it by saying the stormy petrel of crime, which is really hard to forget once you've heard it.
Mm-hmm.
Watson shows him the letter. Of course, Holmes analyzes the writing, because that's what he does. That's what Mycroft was doing. When as soon as Mycroft gets a letter, he analyzes writing too. We saw in Greek Interpreter. And Holmes notices that it's a woman's handwriting. And Watson's like, what? Because it's from his friend Percy. And Holmes is like, no, it's not only from a woman, but it is a client. It is a woman of rare character. He can read that she's some kind of strong woman, you know, that has written this. And that, he says, my interest is already awakened in the case, because this guy has this woman of rare character to write his letters for him. So let's go. And they head off to Briar Bray to see Percy Phelps. But first, they run into... and no worries about spoilers here. We've all read the story. They run into the villain of the piece. They run into Joseph Harrison right off the bat with his JH monogram on a locket. So when Holmes says, you're not a member of the family, Harrison right away says, oh, you saw the JH for a moment. I thought you had done something clever.
I love this send up of, you know, I don't even know who Doyle is sending up at this point, because it almost feels like it's a little dig at the readers who have been so obsessed with Sherlock Holmes, because he's doing all these clever tricks and he's making all of these deductions, and that's what makes people so interested in Sherlock Holmes. And here's this guy saying, well, not actually doing anything that clever. Any of you who find it that interesting, well, you guys are just suckers.
It happened in another story too, in Redheaded League, very early on. Jabez Wilson, you know, the red hair, when Holmes then explained how he knew he was in China and did work with his hands and all this kind of stuff. And when he explained it all, Jabez Wilson said, well, I thought at first that you had done something clever, but I see there was nothing in it after all. And Sherlock's like, ah, all right, why do I explain these things to people, Watson?
Well, you know what? Holmes is always sort of like, well, actually, it was completely rudimentary, but then he wants the praise for it, even though it is supposedly completely rudimentary to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, they go in and they head in because Joseph Harrison, it's his sister who has been nursing Percy and is engaged to marry him. They take him in to see him, and Percy's in the room lying on a couch, a young man, very pale and worn. Annie is sitting next to him, and it says that he clutched her hand to detain her. She says, "Shall I leave Percy?" And then he clutches her hand to make sure. So she is his support here. She's the one that is, you know, nursing him, being the strong one for him as he has been suffering from brain fever for so long. He jokes with Watson, "I should never have known you under that mustache. And I dare say you would not prepare to swear to me." We always get Watson in a mustache, but I should have looked it up to see, like, you know, because we know Watson is in the illustrations always with a mustache, but I wonder if that, does that come from Doyle or does that come from Paget?
That part, I'm not sure, honestly.
I wonder what story we know that, you know, that it's confirmed by Doyle himself, but here it's clearly confirmed. Annie is a striking looking woman, a little short and thick for symmetry, but with a beautiful olive complexion, large dark Italian eyes, and a wealth of deep black hair. Watson always gives us the details with the ladies, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's always going to comment on how beautiful they are, and he certainly does with her.
Yeah, and you know, as I was reading this, I wondered if this sort of description of her was meant to throw suspicion on her, because it's mentioned later that the French or the Italians,
yeah,
would be very interested.
The Russians, right? Because it's the Italians that the treaty is with, right?
Oh yeah, you're correct. Just something about that description and how very sort of not typically British she's, yes, described as. She's not pale. She's dark-eyed. She's dark-haired.
It's dark Italian eyes. I mean, she specifically looks not British. Yeah.
Yeah, very much not British. She looks sort of very foreign and again, not very white by this description in a way that sort of with the kind of classifications of people and criminology of the day and whatnot, would have made her, I think, more suspect than if she looked like Mary Morstan.
Yeah.
She looks, you know, very different from Mary Morstan, who's, you know, sort of blue-eyed and blonde and all those things.
He's never seen, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we get Percy's story. Percy's story is, and this is, again, you know, I love to point this out. These Sherlock Holmes stories are about people telling stories, narratives, you know, and truth comes out of narratives. And Percy's story is about this treaty that he has to copy by hand. It's a treaty between England and Italy. And people were still there. Some people were, and many people actually were still in places copying out things by hand. He was a scrivener, although they had already invented things called autocopiers, where you would put them in and it would kind of, you know, you could make copies of things manually. But I'm not surprised the government doesn't use something like that. This has got to be very specific. You have to trust some one person to do this to make sure things don't get out. Of course, it all doesn't work this way. He's got to copy out this treaty. Holmes interrupts him for a question. He says the French or Russian embassies would pay an immense sum to learn the contents. He mentions that Joseph Harrison, whom you saw just now, was in town, and that he would travel down to Woking by the 11 o'clock train with him. So a little clue there for people really paying attention that, you know, he was, you know, in town at the time. And as Percy's writing it, he gets tired. We don't have to go into what the treaty is about. But he says, I was feeling drowsy and stupid, partly from my dinner and also from the effects of a long day's work. A cup of coffee would clear my brain. Not coffee with vodka and Amaro, you know, but coffee would have helped him.
Yeah, I think that combination would cancel each other out.
Well, he calls for coffee and a woman comes and he's surprised. And apparently it's the commissionaire's wife. The commissionaire, for people to remember, is you almost always decommissioned soldiers who now have these jobs as like security guys, porters, door people, and this is his job here. He's after hours. He takes care of, you know, things that need to be taken care of, and also is this kind of security person. But his wife is there because she cleans the place, and the coffee never comes. Feeling more drowsy than ever, he walked up and down the room, and then he was going to go find the commissionaire for the coffee. And then he shows Sherlock a rough chart of the place. And I love this, that we get within the text a hand-drawn map. Where is it? Here it is. And the fact that it's within the text, too, like it's an actual clue. It's the very thing that he would have handed Sherlock, and for Sherlock to see, share a picture of it here. It's easily, you can easily tell it's hand-drawn with the script here and the letterings. It's a little bit rough. It's not perfectly, you know, worked out here.
Well, so, and that kind of thing would have been very common in Victorian novels and stories of the period, where you always have like fragments of a newspaper, fragments of a letter, or sort of other kind of textual apparatuses, I guess. You get this in the name escapes me at the moment, but you even get this in novels by Jules Verne in France, but also in all sorts of kind of science fiction, horror, detective stories.
In those Verne novels or any of those, do you remember, do they literally show it as if it was in real life too? So this kind of...
Verne's from the Journey to the Center of the Earth, the way they find the entrance to the center of the earth is some writings by this 12th century Icelandic guide. So there's actual kind of runes in the text and whatnot that are supposedly written on a document that he left, or written on the wall as they're following kind of the path. And then of course in Rider Haggard's novel She and his other novels, there's all sorts of like documents and maps and all kinds of things that they're following to find a mummy or a treasure or whatnot. So it's a kind of world building that the Victorian writers were doing. I mean, today we have all sorts of technologies to flesh out a fictional world. We have all sorts of, you know, tie-in novels and 3D technologies, but back then they just had the text and these things they could put in the text, but it really gives the sense of a more real, fleshed out, three-dimensional world.
It does, and especially as it looks real. Like, and it happened in Reigate Squires too, when they had the piece of the writing from the, you know, that was torn off of the letter, and then at the end they showed it at the end complete, and it's like this is a facsimile of what it actually looked like. And I think that really brings a reader in even further. When this was published in America, the same time this story in Harper's Weekly, this is what their drawing was, and they completely missed the point of it. This kind of, you know, by cleaning it up and making it very, you know, like the very neatly printed letters, and this looks like, you know, on the left here in this story published in The Strand, this looks like Percy drew it. this on the right here looks like somebody cleaned it up and made a nice copy of it for the story. And I, you know, it's a shame that it's like that. It's what they thought was important. But even like the little steps here, they're all just little scribbled lines.
Yeah, and it's kind of a shame when you sometimes go look for a story like this on, you know, Project Gutenberg or Wikisource or something, because this is all in the public domain. Those are wonderful resources, but often they omit details like this, like they don't have the drawing or the letter or whatnot. So yes, the text is in the public domain. You have access to the text, but so many of those details get lost.
He says right here, it's a rough chart of the place, so it should look a little rough. And this one does in the story. I like when we get these little, you know.
Well, and the American edition, if you can bring it back for just a second. Huh? I think the American edition, they add Whitehall on the right. So.
Oh, they do. Yeah.
It doesn't just say, you know, the street. It says exactly what street, like you've taken this from a map.
Yeah.
But, you know, in Percy's quick sketch, he doesn't label what street it is. He just says, you know, the street and the door.
Yeah. Well done. I didn't notice that. Mm-hmm. Sherlock loves this. Thank you. I think that I quite follow you. Percy says that he finds the commissionaire asleep in his box, the kettle boiling. And then when he's there, the bell over the commissionaire rings, and he says, and then the commissionaire says, well, if you're here, who's ringing the bell? Whose bell is it?
It's like that horror movie moment of like, the call is coming from inside the house. Like, there's supposedly only however many of us are in the house. The door is locked, but the call is coming from inside the house. So who else is here?
Oh, that bell's coming from your office. So, well, they rush up to the office, no one in the room, and everything says he left it, except the treaty is gone. The copy was there, but the original was gone. They, you know, rush out. Holmes has questions right away, though. He says, what did you do then? He says, he asked him, you know, no one could be concealed in the room. Holmes has questions right away. Like, let's make all this, let's, you know, get all this details out now. Could anybody have been there? You know, nobody could have secured themselves in the room. Percy mentions the time. He said it was, he heard three chimes from a neighboring church. It's 9:45. And Holmes says, that is of enormous importance, making a note upon his shirt cuff. So number one, the time for Holmes is very important, and we'll find out later why that is true. But also, I love, he's writing notes on his shirt cuff. I can't remember if this is the first story that happens in, but this is not an unusual thing for Victorians, is to write on their shirt cuffs, especially because frequently their shirt cuffs would be, and sometimes their collars would just be disposable. They would be paper and not, you know, fancy linen. And you would attach them, these paper cuffs or paper collars, to your outfits. And then you would wear them for a few days and you would throw them away. So
that sounds so uncomfortable to just have paper around your neck, but, you know, personal preference.
So Holmes is taking notes in a shirt cuff.
I guess it is very convenient that you're literally wearing a notebook at all times.
Yep. Although even it could have been even cloth, and like Sherlock wouldn't have cared. He's probably a pencil. You can, that'll be washed out anyway for real. But, you know, but I love the shirt cuff as a notepad. Mm-hmm. Well, they immediately suspect the commissionaire's wife, of course, because she was there. And then when she leaves, she was the only one seen leaving. And the other clue that Holmes asks about is the corridor, Percy says, which led to the room, was laid down with a kind of creamy linoleum, which shows an impression very easily. We examined it very carefully, but found no outline of any footmark. And then Holmes says, had it been raining all the evening? And he says, since about 7. So, but there was nothing wet there. Why didn't she leave footmarks? Because she takes her boots off. But this is the other big clue. There's two big clues. The time and that there were no footmarks from the rain in the place. Well, Holmes asked if there was any smell. Well, we never thought of that, Percy says. And Holmes says, a scent of tobacco would have been worth a great deal to us in such an investigation. And Percy says, I never smoke myself, so I think I should have observed it if there had been any smell of tobacco. I think it's suspicious for a Doyle.
That Percy doesn't smoke.
Yeah, for Doyle to say, now like... You're bullied as a kid, and now you've got brain fever, and you don't even smoke. So I think these are little cultural judgment things from Doyle, from the way he thinks men should live themselves and present themselves. Percy cannot smoke. I'm totally fine with Percy not smoking. But I think Doyle puts it in there. The fact that he doesn't smoke. Come on, all men smoke. What do you mean you don't smoke at this time, right? So, but Percy doesn't smoke, so he didn't smell anything there. Well, they rush off to Mrs. Tangi's house, the commissionaire's wife, and she acts suspicious and she runs away from them at first. But she tells them she thinks they're the brokers coming because we've had trouble with some tradesmen. I don't know if the brokers would have been actually there to collect money or whether they were there to repossess things, maybe, that they had been behind in their bills for. But they take the commissionaire's wife in to Scotland Yard, where she was handed over to the female searcher. So they have a female.
Yeah, speaker. I love that little detail of sort of procedure of how they have a female searcher for the female suspect.
Because there wouldn't have been women in the police, but they would have had some there to you know be able to search the women who were arrested. Mm-hmm. And they,
yeah, I mean, it's all of these. I think instances of you know women doing invisible jobs. Sort of that female searcher, the sort of the commissioner's wife who is doing kind of the cleaning. The commissioner is the one who's sort of doing the security, but his wife is doing the cleaning, which is the less noticeable job. But she only becomes noticeable once she becomes a suspect. Otherwise, her work is kind of less visible, less significant.
And now, but they can find nothing on her, and it's not her. And I think Holmes is also convinced at this point that it's probably not her. But this is when the horror of my situation came in its full force upon me. According to Percy, it was horrible. He says, Watson there would tell you that I was a nervous, sensitive boy at school. It is my nature. So not only was he a smart kid, but he was also nervous and sensitive, and they were beating him on the playing fields. This is full on public school bullying going on here. That's what this was. So,
this is not a story that shows Watson in a good light.
No. But then he's thinking he's ruined, shamefully, hopelessly ruined, and he kind of goes off his head. He's a raving maniac. He started, you know, to pace around and shout and scream. And this is when he just goes. There was happened to be a doctor who took charge of him and took him home. And then as soon as he gets home, Joseph was bundled out of his room living there, and Percy was put in that room. And then he was there for the entire 9 weeks, and another piece for Holmes to put together here. And they've been there ever since. And then we have one. I turn to you, Mr. Holmes, as absolutely my last hope. You're my only hope, Obi-Wan Kenobi. If you fail me, then my honor as well as my position are ever forever forfeited. The nurse poured him out a glass of some stimulating medicine. I don't know if it was brandy, but
I was literally about to say, you know,
we'll get
brandy.
It. We'll get it.
there is a brandy moment in the story, and I thought of you when I read that, Ed.
And then Holmes has more questions here, of course. You know, did you tell anyone about this? And, you know, he's got all these questions. He'll get information from the police, from Forbes, you know, so don't worry about it. And then here it is, Anastasia, the weirdest thing, I think, in all the stories so far. The police don't always use what they know to their advantage. What a lovely thing a rose is. Mm-hmm. And then he pulls out this moss rose, which was a dainty blend of crimson and green. It's not an actual, it's a moss rose is a little different than regular roses. I put a link in the, there'll be a link in the chat here about it. Moss roses are these, a larger centifolia group of roses that produce a sticky, soft growth to ward off sap sucking insects like aphids. And they didn't originate in England, but they were brought there from Europe and then were highly cultivated in the 19th century. So that, there's a reason why I'm saying that now. But this speech, you want to read his little speech there? There is nothing?
Mm-hmm. There is nothing in which deduction is so necessary as in religion, said he, leaning with his back against the shutters. It can be built up as an exact science by the reasoner. Our highest assurance of the goodness of providence seems to me to rest in the flowers. All other things, our powers, our desires, our food, are all really necessary for our existence in the first instance. But this rose is an extra. Its smell and its color are an embellishment of life, not a condition of it. It is only goodness which gives extras. And so I say again that we have much to hope for from the flowers.
I put the picture.
He looks like such an aesthete there.
Doesn't he? It's just like, was it Oscar Wilde story all of a sudden?
it's very sort of first few chapters of Dorian Gray, which, you know, Dorian Gray literally starts, the first line, it starts with the smell of flowers wafting in through the windows.
But for Sherlock to do that, this is the whole thing is strange in that it is. Well, I mean, what he says here, what you just read, basically it is the goodness of providence, you know, this force in the universe that, you know, the reason for things happening, the goodness of providence can be seen in the beauty of flowers.
I do think that that's interesting because, you know, especially in modern day adaptations, Sherlock Holmes is so often portrayed as an atheist because he's a rational person, he's a thinker, he's a logician, and therefore that must mean, you know, that he's too rational to have faith. But that's a very modern attitude. I mean, some of our greatest writings on logic and reasoning have come from theologians and men of faith who are, you know, trying to figure out theological conundrums, you know, questions, like what we call theodicy, which is, you know, if God is good, then why does evil exist in the world? Things like that. And they applied logic to that. So that seems to me to be in line with a very long history rather than something strange and out there. But I think modern readers often have trouble with this because we tend to see religion as a stark opposite to something like science or reason or objectivity.
What works for Doyle especially, and these two lines here, though, nothing in which deduction is so necessary as in religion. So you need logical deduction in religion, Holmes is saying. And it also, in that it can be built up as an exact science by the reasoner. Religion, you can do that. And this lines up in that time at all with all the kind of, you know, applying scientific methods to things that like religion or to psychical experiences. You know, this is the psychical research time here. Doyle is involved in and will be involved in his whole, and he's already doing it actually at this stage of his life. It doesn't only happen later. He does it for his whole adult life, using the scientific method that, in a sense, to prove that the spiritual world exists. He begins this. He actively promotes spiritualism in his later years, but it's in 1887. You know, when he's 29 years old, just after he's published Study in Scarlet, that he kind of starts researching this stuff and meeting people and talking with people about these things. And it's the kind of build up to spiritualism as an exact science. Now that's Doyle. Now Holmes here is just kind of applying that thought here, that way to reason through things that we might not normally, or that we would normally just not understand. They're just spiritual, or it comes from God, and don't just accept that, but figure it out instead. It's interesting that he kind of, though, Holmes ignores, he talks about how the color and the scent are like a beautiful thing, but literally the color and the scent are actually necessary. Like, that's, flowers have this. It's a way for them to survive. They do play a role in their survival.
And also the fact that particular type of rose is cultivated, like didn't just sort of like, you know, come into being naturally, whatever that means. Like we made it. The providence is not involved in the existence of this specific type of rose.
Yeah, this was the rose, the moss rose that Holmes is admiring, was likely developed on purpose by the gardeners there. But that doesn't mean there's nothing wrong with his argument that kind of beauty in the world makes it a better place. It can inspire you. You can see the goodness in the world when you see beauty in it. That all works. But it's still just, he's talking about a case, and suddenly Holmes doesn't go off into these reveries of these kind of unusual behavior usually. And matter of fact, I don't think he's done it in any story.
Well, I think he does, but it usually has a purpose, and usually that purpose is for him to look eccentric or throw people off the scent. You know,
is he doing that here? Do you think? Do you think he's throwing them off the scent that he knows what's going on, and he doesn't want them to know?
It's interesting because, I mean, Holmes seems to figure everything out quite early, but he's so tight-lipped for this entire story. And, you know, poor Percy, he's just so stressed out. Like, the poor guy really has been through the ringer. And Holmes is so laconic about the kind, you know, whether or not there's any hope for solving the case, whether he has any lead. He's just very tight-lipped about it. It's give the guy a break. It seems like he wants everybody in that household to feel like he's just in the deep end and doesn't know what he's doing.
Wants to throw them off guard, because then he knows that the solution of the mystery is here. So, you know, like, she's like, are you going to solve this? And he's like, oh, the mystery. Like, oh yeah, that's right. We're talking about something here. And he's like, I'll look into it and I'll let you know. And do you see any clue? And he says, you have furnished me with 7. And I didn't take it. I thought, like, am I going to? No. And I didn't go in and define what I think. I think other people have done it, and it's hard to figure out. We know the time and the no wet footmarks, but, and you've maybe that for 9 weeks have passed and nothing has happened, that he's been in the room the whole time. We're not quite sure what each of the 7 clues are, but Holmes is going to look into it.
Yeah, but again, Holmes knows so much more than he's letting on in this moment, and he's just, poor Percy, as somebody who often has anxiety and stress over situations myself. Poor Percy.
He says, "I shall be in a fever till I see you again." Yeah, brain fever is what you're going to be in again. And then Holmes is kind of throwing cold water on their hopes a bit, you know? He's not. But again, I just wonder if it's, and Doyle doesn't say later in the story that Holmes doesn't say, like, oh yeah, I didn't want them to think I was figuring it out yet. But that might just be for us to figure out that this is what Holmes is doing. Well, let me, at this moment, before we continue, take a moment to thank all of you for watching this episode. As a nonprofit organization, the Rosenbach Museum and Library depends on the generosity of friends and supporters like you to keep programs like this free and accessible to hundreds of fellow Sherlockians worldwide. I hope you will consider supporting the Rosenbach and Sherlock Mondays by donation, which you can do so at our website, or you can become a member. Membership gives you free museum admission, discounts on programs and courses, exclusive invitations to member-only events, and early access to program and course registration. You can learn more about how to become a member on our website. There are lots of great in-person programs and online programs. I want to specifically mention an online course that is coming up. It actually starts a week from when this show is live. And that is a course taught by Juliet Wells on David Copperfield, Charles Dickens's David Copperfield. And it's David Copperfield through 21st Century Eyes, and it's David Copperfield, Barbara Kingsolver's new novel, Demon Copperhead, which is taking David Copperfield and putting it in the Appalachia in the, I think, 1980s or nine. No, I think it's closer to now, the opioid epidemic in present day. And also the Armando Iannucci film of David Copperfield from a few years ago. Really great course online that you can watch from anywhere. And there's still some spots left in that class. And I don't want anyone to miss our Sherlock Mondays Hound of the Baskervilles BiblioVenture. When Sherlock Mondays comes to a close with the adventure of the empty house, we're going to do a BiblioVenture that will be a pay-only series for just Hound of the Baskervilles. 8 episodes. You know, it was originally a serial story, and we'll treat it that way as well. That will happen in all the Mondays in May and June this year, 2024. Same format. My wonderful co-hosts here, like Anastasia, will be on. And the cost is $80 for it. But if you're a member of the Rosenbach, it's $50. And we're going to have not only our 4 co-hosts returning, Anastasia and Monica Schmidt and Mariel Caro and Curtis Armstrong, we're going to have more co-hosts too. So stay tuned soon when I reveal, not this week, but in a future episode, when I reveal the new co-hosts that will join us for that. So we'll have, you know, the returning co-hosts and new ones. It'll be a lot of fun. I can't wait to do Hound, Anastasia. That is just going to be...
It's one of my favorite Holmes stories. In fact, I contributed to an anthology where each of the writers had to write about why their favorite story was the best Sherlock Holmes story. And I wrote about Hound of the Baskervilles, which was the most obvious choice, but I begged to do that one.
That's great. Well, you can tell people why when you're on the Hound show. So... back to the story. Holmes and Watson are going to go back to London. Holmes is in profound thought, and he does it again, Anastasia. We have another little reverie here that doesn't attach to the story at all. This time he sees that he looks out and sees these buildings rising above in these brick islands, and they're the board schools, Watson says, and Holmes says, lighthouses, my boy, beacons of the future, capsules with hundreds of bright little seeds in each, out of which will spring the wiser, better England of the future. I suppose that does not drink.
There's so much packed in there. It reminds me of the beginning of A Case of Identity, where Holmes imagines, like, what if they were to go out of Baker Street and just kind of fly over London and look down into every house and into every attic and see what's going on? It's that kind of looking down from above and thinking about the people that are in there, the kinds of lives they're leading. That's a very interesting view from above.
And then there's the, I can't remember which story it is, when they're looking out the window on the train, And Watson's like, look, isn't it beautiful? And Holmes is like, oh, this is where all the crime can go unpunished out here in the countryside when, you know, nobody can hear the screams of going on. Very grim. But here, this is a very hopeful. The board schools, everyone, were these new schools that were just being built then with government money to educate children. It was just part of this, like, let's get all children should have real educations. And it's here we get a little bit of, you know, contemporary kind of current events, Holmes commenting on this thing that's going on. It's just, it's twice now we've had these little reveries.
And it's such a hopeful perspective on the future where, so this is being written in the 1890s, which is sort of very known for being this decade of kind of, it's called the fin de siècle, literally end of the century. There was a lot of sense of like running out of steam, kind of the world coming to an end, the century coming to an end, like there being a hard limit to how much progress forward we can have. That there is a lot of that kind of weighing down the literature of the 1890s. But this is just such a hopeful little moment there.
Yeah. I can't help but think, though, in a story where Doyle knows I have to double this mystery that I could easily write in the usual length, that we have things like this. Like, this is Doyle given the opportunity to add some things that he would love for his characters to say and talk about, and he has the room in this story to add these things.
Mm-hmm.
They get back. The biggest question, of course, and as we're talking about the case, is who is it that profits by it? And Holmes doesn't. Even Lord Holdhurst is going to be a suspect. Holmes, as usual, sends out a bunch of telegrams. This time to find out the cabbie, and we find out why the time was so important to him. Is that he sends out for a $10 reward for the number of the cab which dropped a fare at or about the door of the Foreign Office at 9:45 in the evening on May 23rd. And Holmes knows that the person came in a cab, but he knows what time he was dropped off. He knows he came in a cab because there's no wet footmarks. So somebody who had dry feet was dropped off in a cab, went in the place, and then Holmes mentions that the bell ringing is the most distinctive feature of the case. Why should the bell ring? And he has all these questions, and that's one thing that that's the thing he's trying to figure out. You know, like, he has a general idea that how to solve this. It's at the house. It must be connected there. But he needs to put the other pieces together in order to figure it all out. He goes and meets with Forbes, the policeman, and puts him in his place. Forbes is like, I've heard of your methods before now, Mr. Holmes, said he tartly. And Holmes right away, he's like, Like, I always give the police credit. But, you know, I don't blame you for not knowing. You're young. You know, don't work against me. And then Forbes is like, okay, I'd be glad of a hint or two. Tried to come off tough with Sherlock, and Sherlock's, no, I'm not having any of that. And then they have all these questions. And this, I think, is clearly Doyle has the room to do this. This list of questions between them to figure out things that, you know, it clears the suspects. It's not the commissionaire and his wife. You know, this Holmes needs to know this stuff to solve the case or to make sure of it. But it almost becomes, for a Sherlock Holmes story, it's filler. Wouldn't be filler in a normal story. You'd have these police procedurals, this kind of stuff goes on. But for this kind of story, it strikes that way because we're used to these far more condensed. And now they're going to go see Lord Holdhurst. And then, to be concluded next month. So readers would have to wait an entire month, the Strand readers, to find out the rest of this story. If they were reading the American, and there was an American strand, they had to wait a month. But if they were reading the Harper's Weekly, they just had to wait a week. So Harper's Weekly did it in two weekly installments. So there were Americans who knew the solution before the Brits.
That's like the opposite of when Sherlock aired and PBS aired it like 5 months after the BBC aired it. It's like, come on, guys, five months. everybody pirated, because this was like, you can't do it. Two and three.
So everybody's too connected. So. Yeah. Well, the next issue, they go off. They see Lord Holdhurst, who receives them with old-fashioned courtesy. Sherlock tells him that Sherlock guesses. He thinks that he says perhaps the thief's presence in the room is purely accidental. He saw the chance and he took it. And this to me seems to me, this is the real clue for me as a reader, thinking like that Holmes has figured it out. He's gotten this now that, oh, this is what, and now what he needs to do is confirm things with everybody, with Forbes, now with Holdhurst. And what he confirms with Holdhurst is no news has broken about this treaty. And yet this was, you know, it was 9 weeks, you know, since it's been stolen. So it should be, you know, if somebody stole it and took it to or sold it to the French or the Russians, things would have come out. And Holdhurst confirms that is the, and then Holmes also kind of tests him a little bit here. He says, because he mentions that maybe if the thief had a sudden illness, and then the statesman Holdhurst has an attack of brain fever, for example, flashing a swift glance at him. It's almost like Holmes wants to see Holdhurst's reaction to, like, what if Percy took it? What would you think?
I think this becomes so interesting because this is this tiny case, but which supposedly has, you know, Europe-wide or even worldwide repercussions. And we get mention of that kind of thing often in other stories, or, oh, Holmes helped the royal house of this or that, or the King of Bohemia. But here it's sort of directly part of the case. It's not just a mention. And this is almost like a spy story. It's a detective story. But for me, it almost veers into spy fiction, where there in spy fiction, there's often some kind of important document or technological boondoggle or a secret or like a list of cover names or what have you, some kind of important thing. And the plot really circles around getting access to that top secret thing. And there's a lot of investigating and there's a lot of disguise and following down leads. And that all has, or can have, if the wrong people get their hands on it, worldwide repercussions. So in so much spy fiction, even though the story itself is kind of very tight and focused on a small group of characters trying to get that piece of information, it happens with that knowledge that if that information comes out, if the wrong person gets their hands on it, the very configuration of the world as we know it might shift. So you have this almost typical Sherlock Holmes story of his doing the investigating, but underneath you have this current of the very configuration of kind of European powers is at stake here.
Yeah.
The position of the British Empire is at stake here, but it also feels like a, you know, regular Sherlock Holmes story.
Mm-hmm. And it also, and by, and we get that especially through Holdhurst here, because these are the people involved in these kind of, you know, foreign affairs. We don't have what you would call the spy story necessarily yet, but we have stories of intrigue that have been happening.
I mean, it depends on how you define spy fiction, you know, and of course there's literary spy fiction, but then there's also like the spy movie, which is a slightly different category. But certainly, I think we're getting kind of debatably early stories of of intrigue and political intrigue of that kind of
Well, Sherlock doesn't go down this road because it's not there in the story, unfortunately. That would be really great if it was. But he does make a comment about Lord Holhurst, how he's struggling to keep his position and he's not rich because he can tell how his boots have been resold. And again, throwing another character here for the reader, like, could it be Holdhurst now? And Holmes is testing him out to figure if maybe he's involved, because especially as you were saying, people could think that this is a story about this kind of international intrigue, and it could very much feature him. Mm-hmm. Well, they travel back to Briarbrae to visit Phelps. Holmes now mentions more French talk here, Anastasia. His conversation, I remember, was at the Bertillon system of measurements, and he expresses enthusiastic and admiration of the French savant.
Well, you know, these days, Bertillon is a very well-known French ice cream parlor in Paris. It's known as sort of... it's one of those old-timey, old-fashioned ice cream parlors in Paris that is in the very sort of heart of Paris. So I don't think they mean this Bertillon, but that's what that made me think of.
No, the one they mean is Bertillon, who is came up with a system of measurements, measuring physical parts of the body to determine identity, head length, head.
The fingerprints guy.
Yeah, and he also kind of developed the idea of the mugshot. Eventually, fingerprints then replaced this whole system of measurements. You didn't need that stuff, but you know, it's a time there when they're arresting criminals, and there's only so much they could go, and especially if they don't have a headshot of them. A way to identify them were certain measurements that would stick pretty much true for everyone, like the length of your middle finger and the head and all these different little measurements. And if somebody matched up, it's clearly the same person, but fingerprints wind up taking the, you know, the role there. Well, they get back to, but again, it's also Holmes being interested in the development of criminal detection, and that he's aware of these things going on and likes to talk about them. They get back to Phelps. Holmes doesn't have, he says, God, I don't, you know, I'm thinking of, I have a couple inquiries, but you know, haven't figured it out yet. And then Percy had another adventure. An intruder tried to break into his room. He tells another story. Percy gets to tell the stories here. Mm-hmm. This is the first night he'd slept without a nurse in the room, and he wakes up and he hears a sound. That he wakes up and there's a man at the window with looked like a long blade, and then he was gone like a flash. And he shouted, and then that brought Joseph down, and he roused the others. Joseph and them went looking, and they thought, like, oh, he must have gone over here, and he went over this place in the fence. Holmes decides, well, let's go out and see. And he tells, and this is where he tells Annie, Miss Harrison, he says, don't go anywhere. He says, I want you to stay in this room and not move at all. Without telling the others, he's told this to her. And then she stays there with an air of displeasure. She thinks she's being like, you know, he's like, we don't need the women around for this. And he keeps her through. But this is because he needs somebody to stay in the room, because Holmes has figured out that this room is the key. It must be in this room. They go out and he realizes that Harrison's lying, that clearly nobody, you know, went over the fence there. And it's another scene where Doyle really takes his time for a lot of questions and observations. And we don't really learn anything much. I mean, this is another stretch where we're getting this, what would normally happen in an investigation, But in a regular, a story of usual length, this stuff you can get in a paragraph or a couple sentences, and then you're past it. So this is Holmes dotting every, crossing every T and dotting every I to make sure he's figured it all out before he can set his trap for Harrison. Which is that he forces Annie to promise she'll stay in the room until she goes to bed, and then taking the key with her, locking the door, taking the key, brings Phelps to London. But don't bring, Phelps even says, can we bring Joseph? No. Don't bring Joseph. Holmes has got it figured here. This is the guy.
Yeah, he's bringing a trap without telling anybody he's bringing a trap, which, again, it feels like such a Mission Impossible, moment to me, the movies, at least. Where there's this, trickery, they're springing a trap, but even the audience doesn't know they're springing a trap until they pull the masks off at the end of the scene.
Well, he sends him off, Phelps with Percy with Watson. My friend Watson is a medical man, and he'll look after you. Yeah, like he did when you were kids, right? Gonna whack you in the shins. Be careful, Percy. And then he tells Percy that, and then when they get to the train, he's like, yeah, because somebody gets to the train, he's like, I'm not going. You guys go, and you'll have a lot to talk about. And they do, and then we get a little bit of Watson and Percy in London. Percy's all worried. Again, this is more story, that Doyle gets to add here that we normally wouldn't get. And it's a little funny here because it's Percy kind of, going a little, crazy here, at the house or at Baker Street. And he was still weak and his misfortunes made him querulous and nervous. Watson endeavored to interest him in Afghanistan, in India, in social questions. Percy can't help but talk about but what's going on there and where's it? Of course he is.
Percy is just in such a precarious position. And yes, in a way this is of his own making. He should have been more responsible with that treaty edit. But it's another one of those stories where you're reading it and you just realize how precarious existence within the social world of Victorian Britain was, where you make one mistake, you take one wrong step, and just you're ruined forever.
Yep.
And it's, as much as we often kind of romanticize the world of Sherlock Holmes with the gas lamps and the handsomes, but there's so many stories where the main characters would have just ended up in absolute ruin if it hadn't been for Sherlock Holmes's marvelous powers and his intervention. And it's a little heartbreaking to read.
And also we get the affirmation of Holmes's abilities. You have implicit faith in Holmes. Percy asks, I have seen him do some remarkable things, Watson said. But never anything that as dark as this. And Watson's like, oh yes, he can do this. So we get this kind of puffing up of Sherlock's reputation here.
To my knowledge, he has acted on behalf of three of the reigning houses of Europe in very vital matters. And there's, I'm sure dozens of articles on which reigning houses. I think we know one of them is very definitely the British royal family, but which other two?
The reigning houses. Yeah, I don't know. Does Bohemia fall in there? So I'm not.
Honestly, Doyle probably just plucked a random number and stuck it down there. But it's no fun to say that. It's more fun to, find reasons to speculate.
And Watson is assuring him that don't worry, if he's on the scent, he's going to follow this through. And so they spend the night, and Sherlock shows up the next morning with his hand bandaged, his face very grim and pale. And, what happened? And tell us. And he's like, after breakfast. And
he's just, this is one of my favorite scenes of him being just a complete, you know, drama queen, to put it mildly.
Mrs. Hudson has risen to the occasion with her curried chicken here. Her cuisine is very
for breakfast.
Her cuisine is a little limited, but she has as good an idea of breakfast as a Scotch woman. What have you there, Watson? Ham and eggs. Good. Mr. Phelps, curried fowl, eggs, or will you help yourself? And then he's like, come on, take the dish off. He's like, I'm not hungry. Take it off. And he, Phelps raised the cover, as in he did so, he uttered a scream and sat there staring with a face as white as the plate upon which he looked. Across the center of it was lying a little cylinder of blue-gray paper. He screams, and, you know, I still think it's Doyle, you know, portraying Phelps in this light. He caught it up, devoured with his eyes. Then he danced madly about the room, shrieking out his delight. And then, quick, the brandy. They had to pour brandy down his throat to keep him from fainting.
Brandy for breakfast. I mean, you've heard of ice cream for breakfast, but brandy for breakfast.
There you go.
No, but it's just, again, it's this moment of Holmes being so dramatic. Like, he doesn't have to prolong this. He really doesn't. I mean, he's putting this poor man through so much suffering. And Holmes is always complaining to Watson that, like, you're adding romance to the propositions of Euclid, like all my logical deductions, and you should only stick to the logical deductions and the pure reason. And then he goes out and does things like this, which are
performances
that are specifically premised on evoking an emotional response from the audience, not like a cerebral response, but a physical and emotional response from the audience. So, yeah, Holmes, you're interested in more than like the pure proposition.
Percy almost has brain fever again because of it. Holmes says, I can never resist the touch of the dramatic. But I'm thinking,
I think a little more than a touch. And I mean, I think this is a reference. This is an example of, there's a story in which I think it's Watson who says that, the stage lost a fine actor when Sherlock Holmes decided to pursue crime. He's an actor in another story that says he's an actor in a fine one, which of course is Curtis's investiture, because, you know, there's just moments like this where he's acting, he's putting on a performance.
Yeah. For the story too, Percy's a mess. He is not cut out for the Foreign Office. Like, this is not the guy who's supposed to be in charge of these very, you know, important documents. He is just going to go off his head. So hopefully Percy will lead a quieter life after this. I'm thinking the Foreign Office might not be the place for him.
I mean, to be fair, he did get put in charge of, I mean, again, the relations of Britain and multiple other nation state empires.
When things go wrong, you can't lose your head. And Percy's laid up for 9 weeks and then almost laid up again when it was solved. Now we get the explanation. Well, first breakfast. Holmes swallowed a cup of coffee, turned his attention to the ham and eggs. Then he rose, lit his pipe, and settled down into his chair. So coffee, breakfast, pipe. Now I'll tell you the story. So poor Percy, waiting all this time, find out what's going on here. And then it's Holmes gets to tell a story. So now we have another story. This is the third story we've got here. And this time it's Holmes telling the story of his adventure, in which, you know, he, you know, watched the room and Harrison breaks into the room, Holmes watches him the whole time to take the treaty out. He needs to know where it is, right? This is like Scandal in Bohemia. I need the person to show me where the thing is that I need to get. as he tricks Irani Adler.
Well, and it also it's nice to have proof of who it actually is.
Yeah.
I mean, Holmes knows, but it's nice to have, it's important to have proof.
And then Harrison comes out with them. Holmes gives him the old 1-2. He says, I had to grass him twice and got a cut over the knuckles. So, so he, you know, punches Harrison a couple times, and Harrison's like, all right, I had enough. And Holmes makes him give out the papers and then go get out of here. And he tells him to run away. And then I love this, that he figures that, having got them, I let my man go, but I wired full particulars to Forbes this morning. If he is quick enough to catch his bird, well and good. But if, as I shrewdly suspect, he finds the nest empty before he gets there, why, all the better for the government. Holmes is assuming that the government doesn't really want this guy caught and talking to the police and saying what happened, that this is, you know, it's enough that this, you know, has happened already. The government wants to hush it all up.
Yeah, it's another one of those cases where Holmes solves the crime, but doing with all the procedural things and prosecuting the crime and catching the criminal would actually put the information out. And as we've seen, reputation is so, so important in Victorian Britain. What people think is so, so important. But yeah, in this case, there's also international relations involved. So that's more important than justice for the one perpetrator. Mm-hmm. Reputation and public knowledge are more important.
Yep. And it's not the only time that it's reputation is more important than, you know, catching an actual, than a criminal being punished by the law. Although he could, of course, get caught. I mean, Holmes just leaves it up to the police to go catch him if they can. So the treaty was in the room the whole time. When they rushed Harrison out of the room, when they brought Percy home, he had already stashed it in the room. He could never get to it because there was always a nurse. And then as soon as the nurse wasn't there, that's when he's trying to break into the room. Holmes figures all this out. Apparently Harrison was lost heavily in dabbling with stocks, and he stopped in to see Percy that night and saw the treaty and thought, ha ha, this is my chance. And did not allow either his sister's happiness or your reputation to hold his hand. So he's a bad guy. Holmes comments.
I mean, especially because his sister is the woman in Victorian Britain. Her position would have been so precarious. She would have been relying on first her brother, and then when she's married, on her husband to provide for her. If Percy is ruined, he cannot provide for her. And then by extension, it's either Joseph Harrison's job, or she doesn't really have any other opportunities except to become a governess or something.
Yeah. And now Holmes explains how he solved it. And I love, this is interesting here, right at the end of the story. He says, there was too much evidence. That's what made it hard. What was vital was overlaid and hidden by what was irrelevant. Of all the facts which were presented to me, we had to pick just those which we deemed to be essential and then piece them together in their order so as to reconstruct this very remarkable chain of events. I like this because, you know, I've been talking about how all these scenes and all these conversations are kind of like filler for this story just because it's long. But actually, that showcases exactly what Holmes is saying here, that I had to work through all these things in order to find what was really there. Doyle still could have done this in a lot fewer words, but but at least you wind up with, like, there was a reason for all these conversations that we usually don't get. And of course, the reason for the bell ringing, it was just chance that he happened. He comes in, oh, he's not here, rings the bell, and then sees the treaty. So that was, Holmes has solved it. It's a really odd ending here, I think, to this story, Anastasia, because it's just like a question and answer with Percy that just kind of ends.
Usually it's very abrupt.
Usually we get a wrap up, and here there's no wrap up. It's just, you know, why did he? It's Percy asking questions. Why did he try the window? Oh, because he got past too many rooms to get in the doors. And then Percy says, "You do not think that he had any murderous intention. The knife was only meant as a tool." "It may be so," answered Holmes, shrugging his shoulders. "I can only say for certain that Mr. Joseph Harrison is a gentleman to whose mercy I should be extremely unwilling to trust." That's the end on the uncertainty of Harrison's murderous intent is an unusual way
usually there's some kind of I don't want to say platitude, but some kind of thing or some quotation from some literary work or something. But we've already had the Sermon on the Rose and on the kind of goodness of providence, though you can't put it at the end because it was in the middle. So we get this kind of,
and also you get the opposite. Like you get this, you know, the reveries about, you know, the goodness of providence, and at the end of the story is like, yeah, maybe this guy would have murdered you. Which is basically how it ends. That's a little.
And we're just gonna let him go. We're not gonna arrest him or anything. The police might catch him. They might not. Yeah.
So hopefully, the government will be spared its, you know, embarrassment.
Well, as long as the government is spared embarrassment.
Well, Sherlock.
This was such a, I'm so glad I got to be on for this story. I think I asked for, because it's such a strange story in so many ways. So I'm so happy I got to talk about it.
Thank you. And I just love how you're pointing out this, that it's this kind of international intrigue story, almost a spy story. And that works.
Well, in case you don't know this about me, I am a sucker for spy stories. It's
good.
My favorite genre.
Is it really? I don't think I did.
Well, after science fiction, obviously, right. Of course, good. spy movies, spy fiction is just my favorite thing in the world.
I'll have to talk about that sometime. Got a nice little spy fiction section in my library over here. A few shelves.
Absolutely.
All righty. Well, Sherlockians, thank you for joining us for episode 27 of Sherlock Mondays. Anastasia, you will return for our final wrap-up show.
Yes.
Episode 30. And we talk about, you know, what this whole Sherlockian biblioventure. That'll be a lot of fun, that show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On our next show, everyone, episode 28, Mary Alcaro returns as Holmes and Watson take a nice little vacation to Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland and hope that will their best buddy, Professor Moriarty, arrive in time to admire the falls? Well, you'll have to come back for the final problem on the next episode. Thanks to
I won't spoil what happens, but I will say one of my Sherlockian origin stories is that I thought the final problem was the final Sherlock Holmes story for like a good decade. I read it when I was 12. So once you guys read it next week, you will see why that was so funny.
And it was for the original readers. Thank you to our chat, Mrs. Hudson Brianna, for managing the live chat links. Thank you to the sponsor of Sherlock Mondays, Lisa Washington. We couldn't do these shows without the generous support of our patrons. You can support the Rosenbach through donation. Your support helps us create more programs like this and also care for our collections. You could also become a member. Membership gives you early access and discounts to programs and courses. You can find out more at our website, rosenbach.org. Don't forget, if you haven't already, to sign up for the Hound of the Baskerville show. And again, let me remind you to subscribe to our YouTube channel here and to hit that little thumbs up like button on YouTube for these videos. And if you're listening to the podcast, leave us a review somewhere. That always helps. Anastasia, bye.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Ed.
Good. I'll see you soon for the wrap-up show, everyone. I am Edward G. Pettit of the Rosenbach Museum and Library, where the game is a book. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye. Thank you.
The Rosenbach Museum and Library thanks you for listening to Sherlock Mondays, sponsored by Lisa Washington, hosted by Edward G. Pettit, music by Pleated Gazelle.